Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, day two back from the big pilgrimage. And with me, Joe Heschmeyer, who also went on the big Catholic Answers pilgrimage, Ryan pilgrimage. We went to the place where Christendom started, really. I mean, it's not, as I said yesterday, it's not Rome, it's not Jerusalem. Christendom, as we understand it, started among the Franks when they put this whole thing together. And we, you know, we stood where Charlemagne stood, and where Hildegard stood, and where so many other great saints and heroes of the era of Christendom stood, and we had a wonderful time. Today's show, Ask Me Anything About Catholicism. I'm going to wake Joe up in a minute. I know he's still suffering from jet lag, but when I wake him up, you can ask him anything you want about Catholicism. 888-318-7884. Joe. Joe.
It's good to be here. Where am I?
That's what he said every day in Europe. It's good to be here. Where am I?
It's great to be here. I'm glad that we're doing this show today because I was asleep by a little after 7 on Monday night and didn't make it much longer on Tuesday night. So I think today I can stay to the end of the show, which ends 7 o'clock my time.
I'm really glad to hear it, Joe. I'm really glad you feel you can make it through a two-hour show. 888-318-7884 if you've got questions for Joe. We'll talk a little bit more as we go about the pilgrimage. I think there might be things you want to talk about, Joe. There might be things that I want to, I'm not going to say embarrass you with, but share. Share.
About we have a mutually assured destruction approach here.
I know, that's true, because you have some about me too. All right, the trip was perfect. Joe and I were not perfect. All right, so maybe there are a few little embarrassing details. But it's good to be back. It's always good to be back. But I have to say, I guess we'll get into all of it, but I particularly liked visiting military families over in Germany. That was a great part of the trip. Let me ask you this question. Do you mind if I start you off with a question, Joe? Are you awake enough for that?
Please do.
All right. So I've actually been seeing a lot about this on the internet lately, and this is coming up in debates I'm seeing with Protestant pastors and whatnot. And the claim that, look, the early church taught that Mary sinned. And so this is a way of saying, look, you Catholics, this idea of Mary as preserved from sin is really a late invention. It's not of apostolic origin.
No, it's not true. And it's not true for a couple of reasons. One, because when you say the early church taught that Mary had sin, this sounds as if you're saying there was some kind of church-wide consensus on this score, and that's simply not true. What would be more accurate to say is that early Christians were in the process of getting a more precisely formulated doctrine of things like original sin and Mary's place within that. And we see this in their own writings. So you see, like in the 100s, for example, people like St. Justin Martyr and St. Irenaeus of Lyon comparing Mary to Eve and talking about her as the new Eve who unties the knot of Eve's disobedience through her obedience. And we see her being described as the all-pure ark, and we see all of these kind of poetic descriptions of her. And it's true in the midst of this, there are some church fathers who think that Mary sinned or had original sin, or maybe she sinned one time, but there is this broader trajectory of emphasizing Mary's purity, both external and internal. And so when we have a more precise kind of formulation of the doctrine of original sin, beginning in the 300s with people like St. Augustine, he's very careful to point out that the things he's saying about original sin don't apply to Mary, that he's not arguing that Mary sinned. Now, in his work on Nature and Grace, depending on the version that you're using, they're numbered slightly differently. Some have this as chapter 36, some have it as chapter 42. But he says, after, you know, defending the idea of original sin against the Pelagians, he says, "We must accept the Holy Virgin Mary, concerning whom I wish to raise no question, when it touches the subject of sins out of honor to the Lord. For from him we know what abundance of grace for overcoming sin in every particular was conferred upon her who had the merit to conceive and bear him, who undoubtedly had no sin. Well then, if with this exception of the virgin, and then he goes on. So he's making this broader point about how we all struggle with original sin and that it's actually much worse than some people realize. But in the midst of that, he's very careful to point out, yeah, we're not talking about Mary, though. So this shows that this wasn't some late thing, that as far back as we find really clear formulations of original sin, we find coupled with that a recognition that Mary is a different case, and that she's a different case precisely because of the incredible honor that our Lord pays her beyond the honor of making her his mother, that he blesses her in this unique sort of way, and that the early Christians were right in recognizing this kind of singular honor. So the sinlessness eventually is dogmatically affirmed by the church, but there is a very clear sense quite early on that Mary is special in some way, and that this specialness about Mary makes it so you can't simply assume she dealt with sin in the same way that we do, both original and actual sin.
Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, our number 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. So is it, just to follow up a little bit on that, is it a disingenuous way of arguing or just a misunderstanding maybe of how Catholics view the age of the church fathers? If, say, in some of these online debates, the Protestant minister might say, Here's a church father that believed Mary sinned. Here's another early church person. And so he might come up with a list of three or four or five and says, see, the early church didn't believe Mary was free of sin.
So it's certainly a misunderstanding of how we use the church fathers, because we don't just take individual lines. And I think it does risk at least being disingenuous. It risks being disingenuous for this reason. Let's take the example of modern politics. You could cobble together various sentences from politicians in Party A that sound more like Party B. So like the example that comes to mind offhand, Bernie Sanders is or was a relatively big gun rights supporter because he's from a rural state where gun rights make a lot of sense, and this is quite a break from his normal party. So you could quote him on guns over here, and you could quote, you know, a pro-life Democrat on abortion over there, and you could cobble together some quotations and say, look, the platform of the Democratic Party is the Republican Party platform. But no one who's actually aware of politics would think that was an accurate, honest, good faith read of either party. They would just say, sure, you can find outliers. So you can do that to the church fathers. You can find everything an individual church father gets wrong and cobble those things together. You can find all of the areas that they are outliers and pretend that this is a representative view in the church. One of the most egregious areas this happens is on the canon, which books belong in the Bible, where people will quote Jerome and say, well, look, Jerome says this, but Jerome's views on the Bible were challenged in his day by other church fathers like Augustine. And so it's not simply the case that you can just take a line out of context. There's a broader narrative of what's happening here. So we have to recognize, number one, what did the church broadly believe? Not just what did an individual theologian or bishop believe? And number two, what do we see over time that the Holy Spirit is doing and guiding the church? Because we don't think that every individual sentence from every church father is automatically infallible. It can be helpful evidence in establishing what the church broadly believed, but it would be a mistake to treat stray lines from patristic texts the way you might treat lines from Scripture or the words of Jesus or something like this. That's not an accurate or faithful way of interpreting the church fathers. That's not how the Catholic Church treats the church fathers, and it's not how anyone should treat the church fathers.
Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. We're going to see if he can stay awake for all 2 hours. We'll be right back with more. You can ask him whatever you want about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from Catholic Chemistry, a dating app for Catholics. Founded by a longtime member of the Catholic Answers team, CatholicChemistry.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Are you ready to spread your wings? Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with exclusive news, program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. You can ask him anything about the Catholic faith. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, you are welcome here. Whether you are Catholic or not, whether you're a believer of any kind or not, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Joe, I'll just ask you this before we go to the phones. Did you have a favorite church or saint that we visited on our Europe pilgrimage?
I loved the Strasbourg Cathedral.
Oh, me too.
And
yeah.
I really loved Strasbourg in general. And then I found out a couple days later that my family, one wing of the family, comes from that area, which is kind of cool. But yeah, it's just gorgeous. I loved the Cologne Cathedral. I knew Cologne Cathedral was going to be, it's pretty famous. But if I'm being honest, I actually thought the Strasbourg Cathedral was better.
Yeah, the Strasbourg Cathedral is... it's very satisfying aesthetically. It's just it's huge. It was the tallest building in the world for a couple hundred years, but it doesn't feel disproportionate in any way. Everything seems in exact proportion on that building.
Yeah. The Cologne Cathedral was also the tallest building in the world, wasn't it?
At some point,
period of time,
but, you know,
in the late 1800s?
They didn't finish it until the 1800s. They didn't get that spire finished.
Right.
Like they had bills that piled up. They got things. They had to get the kids to soccer practice. They just never got
there. I understand completely. I've got you know, a cathedral worth of work. I'm going to get around in about 600 years.
I love the cathedrals, too. I'd be like, when was this built? Well, between 900 and 1450. You're like,
oh, I mean, in
okay.
all seriousness,
all right,
the
great.
Cologne Cathedral starts in the 1200s and ends in the 1800s.
I know. You know what, though? It shows stick-to-itiveness. That's what I like. That shows
it's
real
true.
Stick-to-itiveness. I think we don't have that anymore. They just stuck to it. They said, we've put the foundation down. We're going to keep going with
you
this.
You know what? Maybe we should have a little picture of the Cologne Cathedral we put up in the publishing department, because there's some authors who I think it's a similar journey. You know, Todd's got an idea that he started with them, and then 600 years later, he's still trying to get them across
trying to get
the finish line.
To finish the book, yeah.
I'm not going to name any names, but, you know, I'm sure we could.
I think I know who you're talking about. 888-318-7884. I got to say, I really loved Aachen. I didn't know what a feeling I would have standing right where Charlemagne stood, you know, this at the very beginning of what we came to know as Christendom. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. So I was impressed by not only that, but it was in Cologne, actually. So we toured the Cologne Cathedral and then kind of broke away from the main group, and I ducked into a random church.
Was that really random? I think I know what you're going to say, but you just ducked into a random church?
Yeah, no, okay. It was just a completely random. Saw a church, went in. The church itself was not very attractive. It was okay. Started to leave, but then noticed a timeline of the life of Blessed Duns Scotus on the wall.
Oh, Duns
and
Scotus.
And I thought, this has to be the church where Duns Scotus is buried.
There he is.
Who else is this much of a Scotesian? And so I pulled up my phone and checked real quick, and sure enough. And then I did a little bit of exploring in the church and was able to find there was a
you
the
found
tomb
Duns
of
Scotus.
Duns Scotus.
See, I thought you were going to say Albert the Great.
Delightful thing.
Because Albert the Great is buried.
No, I missed
there.
Albert the Great. You had Albert the Great.
Yeah.
I had Duns Scotus. So.
All right, let's go to Steubenville. Oh, it's the Cologne of the Americas. It's the Strasbourg and Aachen of the American church. Nicholas in Steubenville, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Glad to have you here with us, Nicholas. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I are in our 20s, and we're saving for retirement, as you do, and investing for other reasons as well. I'm facing an ethical challenge. For the last 2 years, I've been saving in some non-morally filtered funds, as well as some morally filtered with, you know, Catholic branding in the Middle East. And it's my understanding, though, that for a proportionate reason, you can tolerate the evils of, I guess, the unfiltered funds, the good being the future of your family life or whatever. But it's come to my attention that there are some, I guess, funds that are, I guess, better than the ones I had historically known of. I won't name names, but, they're track market indexes and stuff, and they at least remove some of the more harsh evils, I guess. And I'm like, okay, I don't know if I'm morally, if I'm okay to just continue on as I was. But I guess to boil it down is, are Catholics morally required to utilize the morally filtered funds given their existence, even if for various reasons they prefer secular ones such as convenience or performance? So that's kind of
Not a requirement. It doesn't become sinful to use the non-morally filtered one. So you can't intentionally invest in something that's morally evil, but you can have a situation where you invest in one company and they invest in another company and they invest in something that is immoral. And it's actually very difficult if you do virtually anything in the marketplace to avoid that. I mean, you go on Amazon and Amazon gets some portion of that profit and they're going to use it for whatever nefarious purpose they're going to use it for. And that's largely unavoidable. This is what is called in technical terms, remote material cooperation. They're getting some financial support for the evil that they're trying to do, but you're not giving that to them on purpose for that reason. And your cooperation is sufficiently remote that it is not going to be the make or break for them doing the evil. No one's going to look at that and think that this means that you support the evil and so on. In those cases, if you have a good reason, you can still cooperate with the remote material evil. And in fact, this happens. I think it's probably fair to say that remote cooperation with evils, remote material cooperation with evils, happens daily. You participate in an economy where many of the major players do things that are morally objectionable, and it's very hard to avoid all of that. So occasionally, a conscientious Catholic will propose an alternative that, hey, here's a coffee shop that isn't abominable and supporting terrible things, or here's, another way of buying these goods, or in the case that you're describing, here's a place you can give your money in terms of investing it in the market. Those things can be good, and I think that you should take them seriously as moral options, and it can be what's called a supererogatory good, a good that's over and above what's demanded, where there's a basic moral line beneath which you're sinning, but you might be called to go above and beyond the basic moral line. And I think this would be in that category, where it's not the case that everyone is required to do it, but it might be a good sacrifice. So in concrete terms, it might mean that you make less money. It might mean that it's more of a headache, but maybe this is one of the ways God is calling you to serve him, is to sacrifice some of those lost profits, sacrifice some of that convenience for this good. And if that's what he is calling you to, that's wonderful. But that isn't just automatically morally compulsory on everyone on pain of sin. This is something where, remote material cooperation is not of itself forbidden. It depends on the context. And there's sufficient reasons that people invest in, the stock market where they're not trying to support evils that a company might happen to do.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
No, that's a great answer. So that's very helpful. So I really appreciate that. So thank you, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I think if you want to stay, someone, is that Darren?
That's
I don't
Darren.
Know who D is. Someone in the, Darren, okay, Darren.
Darren's a financial advisor. Is that the right term? Financial
totally
advisor?
Forgot about that.
Yeah. So Darren, our producer, is also a financial advisor. So he'll talk to you. If you stay on the line, he's got some ideas for you.
And it would be sinful to hang up now. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Nicholas, what I really liked, I got to say, about your call, my wife and I are in our 20s and we're planning our retirement. That sounds like something that you're married and you're thinking of family in your 20s. Good for you. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. I mean, that either shows that you got a lot of foresight, or maybe you normally live in Spain.
You live
retirement sits around the corner. So you got like 3 years of working left, so you got to get ready.
What are you talking about, Joe?
Well, they have an early retirement age.
Oh, I didn't know that. All okay. Right. I'm going to let you talk to a professional, an actual professional, our producer, Darren Delosier. Hang on, Nicholas. On we go. I'm sorry. I'm not going to get jokes today. I've had 2 weeks of Joe's jokes, and my brain is turned off. the worst thing that happened about this whole crew, you know what I'm going to say. Of this whole cruise is my wife now loves Joe Heschmeyer even more than she did before. So she's constantly doing a Joe Heschmeyer joke for me. I'm like, that's
your
not
your wife had
don't
some
do
of the
this
best
for
jokes of the trip.
I know the two of
and
you.
And they were just these random like sniper shots from the back of the room. And it was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. You've ruined my life, Joe. Now I have to listen to you.
Oh, you know, the other thing, just to I know people are gonna be very tired of hearing about the cruise. But I made a number of, you know, punny kind of jokes and rolled his eyes and groaned. And yes. And then everyone on the cruise took that as a call to like, let's see if I can do a better pun and Cy will really like that. So it was great because people were telling him these horrible jokes. He
this
was
is what, yeah, people thought that I was entertained by Joe's puns. So they came up to me and they go, hey, I got a good one for you. I was like, no, this is a good one for Joe. Go talk to Joe. Don't do this with me.
They were then telling me very triumphantly what they had done. And it was delightful.
Oh, God, it was miserable. Andy in Long Beach, California, watching on YouTube. We're glad you're here, Andy. Go ahead with your question.
All right. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, Joe, I have a scriptural question.
All right.
In the Bread of Life Discourse, John 6:35 specifically, mm-hmm. When Jesus says, he who comes to me will never hunger, he who believes in me will never thirst. And I was mm-hmm. wondering how we reconcile that with the literal interpretation of the bread and wine and how we can understand that while still holding the literal interpretation.
Oh, yeah. This is a very good question. And it's probably worth saying very clearly, both Catholics and Protestants agree that when Jesus talks about the bread of life, he's giving a metaphor. He is not literally bread, and neither Catholics nor Protestants believe that he is. And so when he says the bread of God is that which comes down from heaven and gives life to the world, he is presenting himself as the new manna. And then he says, I'm the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. So if that was all he said, we would actually be fine with saying, yeah, like you can take that symbolically for sure. But then he actually explains what he means by the bread specifically. And it's not just his teaching, it's himself Eucharistically. So jump down to verse 51, because he's going to define. So both sides agree, bread of life is a metaphor for something. In verse 51, Jesus tells us what the bread of life is a metaphor for, and he's going to tell us it's for himself, and more specifically for his flesh. So he says, I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever, and the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. So this is the bread that he gives for the life of the world. It's not literally bread. It's literally the Eucharist. It's literally his flesh. And that's what he says. So if you were to say that all of that means something else, it means his teaching. He could have said, you know, the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my teaching. But he doesn't. He says the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. So this is the bread. He is the bread. Well, how is he the bread? Because he gives us his flesh. And he does all of that work for us in John 6. He explains what he means by that. And so the Catholic view is not like he doesn't use metaphor, doesn't use spiritual imagery. He certainly does. But that he then explains what that spiritual imagery means, just as he does many of the other times he uses spiritual imagery. So let me give you an example. In John 2, he says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll rebuild it. And John says the temple he referred to was his body. But now imagine somebody said, oh, well, when John says that, he actually meant his teachings. You would say, well, no, he doesn't. John just told you what he meant. He said the image of the temple stands for Jesus' body. Well, here, the image of the bread of life stands for Jesus' body. And we're told that explicitly by Jesus himself. So that's the Catholic view, that by all means, Jesus is the bread of life. And he who comes to Jesus will never hunger, and he who believes in Jesus will never thirst. But the way that Jesus gives himself to us is through his flesh. And if anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which he shall give for the life of the world is his flesh. So that's how we would interpret it, because that's just exactly what he said.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, you bet.
Andy, I'll tell you what. If you'd like the book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus, one of Joe's many fine books, I'd be happy to send it to you. Just hang on, and we'll send you Oh, it's so good to be back. It is so good to be back. I'll send you a copy, Andy. You just hang on and give us an address. The number here is 888-318-7884. I give out the numbers a little bit cautiously because the lines have been tending full. But give it a shot. Lines do open up continuously, so we'd love to get you in. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're a believer of any kind or not, 888-318-7884. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. We've got a pretty good Joe Heschmeyer on the show today. Sometimes we have an excellent Joe Heschmeyer. Sometimes we have a superior Joe Heschmeyer. We've got a pretty good Joe Heschmeyer today, so you're welcome to call 888.
Are you actively discouraging people from calling?
No, pretty good Joe Heschmeyer.
Or I guess
is really
you could
good.
Be like, you have, this is a great time to stump Joe.
No, this I don't think pretty good Joe Heschmeyer is bad. That's better than most of us by a country mile, as they say. I don't actually know why they say country mile. What's different from a country mile than a regular mile? 888-318-7884 is the number. Joe is a shameless papist. Have you even done anything on Shameless Popery, or have you completely ignored your own very popular...
Oh, no. I have been doing things. I inadvertently stirred the pot more than I thought I would.
Why? What'd you do?
I mean, I was talking about the Jewish roots of the phrase, Christ is King, and I knew you'd get some people who... have feelings about Jewish people that are maybe more negative, and that me promoting this would make people upset.
Don't tell me.
But
the anti-Semites came out.
Yeah, there were definitely some. Which again,
really?
I knew I was going to get some of that. I was fully aware that was going to be the price of doing business. But just seeing that kind of stuff on display. Now, some of the people who complained were not, but you got people making like weird memes of me and stuff.
Really? What's the matter with people? What is the matter with people? There is a really strong anti-Jewish thing going around, man. That is not what God wants. Stop it, people. I wish people would. Yeah, that's terrifying. I have a theory about the Jews. It goes like this.
No,
this is my theory about the Jews. See if this pans out for you. Salvation is from the Jews.
Yeah,
Do you agree with that theory?
I dare say. That's a hard one to disagree with.
Yeah, because guess who said that? All right, let's, I'll tell you what, callers, you can guess who said that. Sean is in San Diego, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Hi, Sean. Got a question for Joe?
Hey, guys. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I've been having some conversations with friends and family about IVF, and they're all very good, earnest Catholics, but not maybe so much listening to Catholic Answers all the time or reading about church theology and stuff. And so I just need some help answering some questions. Mainly, it seems to come up in the conversations about how the church arrives at the conclusion that the only licit way to conceive is through natural means. And if God gave medical technology and science to help people with infertility conceive, why that's wrong, or if it is like a natural right to be conceived naturally, how the child is harmed by being deprived of that right if the process predated their conception. And then just as a bigger context, kind of more personal or simple answers or analogies might be helpful in these conversations and explaining these points, but that's kind of the dialogue that's been going on and things that come up in those conversations.
Great. That's a very well-formed question. And it's worthwhile here to approach the IVF topic from several different angles. The people you're talking to, are they pro-life?
Yes, very pro-life.
Okay.
But it doesn't feel like a abortion-related type of issue with them.
Yeah, IVF is one of the major drivers for abortion because of a couple things. You know, you have the fertilization of a lot of eggs, meaning you have the creation of a lot of children in a laboratory, and then you'll have one of a few things happen. Number one, you'll have the implantation of more eggs than the woman actually wants, where maybe she wants one kid and they'll implant three or four eggs just because many times it's not successful and the body will reject and the child will die in their mother. And so then other times, the eggs will all take. So you might suddenly be pregnant with four babies. And then they'll do what is euphemistically called selective reduction, where they choose which of the babies should live and which ones should die. And they will kill the ones they decide are the wrong sex or have the wrong genes or something like this. And it's, abhorrent from both a pro-life perspective and an anti-eugenics perspective, because this is straight up eugenics. Like what we're doing here of carefully choosing which children can come to birth and not based on their genetic factors is exactly the kind of eugenics that we rejected. The third possibility is that you fertilize all these eggs. You maybe only implant one, and that one takes. So now you have these fertilized eggs. You have these unborn children, and they're in a freezer somewhere. And maybe you'll want them later or maybe not. But what often happens is that they slowly die in the freezer. And none of those are things we should be doing to children. Like none of those are appropriate ways to treat human beings. And this whole attitude of treating other human beings like they are products that we can create in a laboratory is itself immoral. That even if you didn't do that, even if you used 100% of the children you created in a lab and let them all come to birth and all of it was 100% successful, none of which is true. But even if it were, treating human beings as products you make in a lab is wrong. It's immoral. There's a reason that Frankenstein is a horror book, that just the act of doing that is wrong. And we recognize it's wrong on a very basic level, because this is not how individuals made in the image of God should be treated. And so, yeah, conceiving them in these ways that don't do justice to human dignity is already wrong. Whatever, you know, the means of a bad conception, you might say, we can recognize, and we should recognize very explicitly, the goodness of the child. So a child born through IVF, a child born through adultery, a child born through fornication, a child born through anything, they're still beloved by God. They're still made in the image of God. They're still wonderful creatures that we should care for and love and everything else. And so if that's, you know, people listening right now, if that's your own story, God bless you. None of this is meant to knock you in the slightest. We can say on the one hand, you are good, and also you deserved better. You deserve to be brought into the world on better terms, in the way humans are meant to enter the world, in a union of a loving husband and wife through the natural means, not in a laboratory, not in an affair, not in sexual assault, not any of those things. So we regularly can and do separate the rejection of the morality of the conception. We can say some encounters are immoral and still affirm the goodness of the child who results from that conception. So that's, I think, at the heart of this. You're misusing the nature of the human body. You're not helping the body do what it does. You're supplanting it. You're not helping, like, you know, contraception is bad because it separates sex from babies, and this separates sex from babies in the opposite direction. And it's this breakdown where the most intimate act of the body should also be the act by which you bring new life into the world, that it should be in this loving embrace as a total gift of self, not this carefully calculated thing that you pay for through a lab service. Much, much more could be said about that. I don't know if that helps or not. And if you want, I have a YouTube video that I did on this that I can recommend as well.
Could I ask just a quick follow-up?
Because please.
The conversations have been very, like I said, very good faith and honest. I think the response to that would be, like, we've had these hypotheticals where we'll say, let's say that in the future the technology is so much, we're just doing one egg, one sperm, mm-hmm. one fertilized embryo, and it's going to take, like, we take all those variables out, it's going to a married couple that wants to raise the child in their house. I understand that the marital act is sacred and good, but what can I point them to show that only the marital act is good for conception and not scientific means or medical technology? What's the immorality that I can explain to them about those procedures within that hypothetical where we take out the horrors of the IVF industry?
Yeah. No, that's a good question. And that's where I was saying, you know, it's wrong to bring people into conception through a lab. That, you know, in the same way, like, we would be against surrogates and all of this. So in the hypothetical you're describing, is surrogacy part of it or no?
I would say no, like, it's being implanted into the wife of a married couple.
Oh, I see. Okay. Even in that case, you're not helping the couple to conceive in a marital way. You know, so for example, there can sometimes be a medical issue with either a man or a woman where they're not able to just have children. You know, they struggle with fertility. And there are ways of helping them to get over whatever those, you know, physical barriers are, et cetera, where you help the body to perform as it's meant to perform. And in those cases, that is absolutely good. It's helping people to act in the way that they're meant to act, to live out their bodies and like the meaning of their bodies and the meaning of their marriage and everything else in a way that brings new life into the world. IVF works around that. It doesn't address whatever the underlying issue is and instead puts children in labs. And if you imagine children are just things that we can decide to create on demand, then that might make total sense. And in a modern kind of consumer world, a sort of have it your way sort of approach to life, then you can understand why this is very attractive to people. But if these unborn children are human beings with all the same rights and dignity as mom and dad and everything else, you can't treat another person that way. It's wrong to treat children as accessories. And it, look, it's possible to treat children as accessories even in a natural birth, and you know, where you're just having a kid because it's that stage of life, and you treat them as sort of a prop. They look good in the Instagram pictures, etc., and you don't really give justice to the child's humanity and dignity. And that's wrong too. This is more egregiously wrong for the same reason, that you're using a child that you had no right to do this to in this way that is contrary to their dignity. And so it is hard. Like, people who no longer see why it might be wrong to make kids in labs, I think we have a moral sort of numbing that has been going on. When, I believe it was Time, maybe Newsweek, one of the two, first reported on test tube babies in the 1970s, people were shocked. They were horrified. And this was culture-wide, regardless of religion. And now the moral shock and outrage about that has completely gone away, but we're still doing the same thing people were justifiably shocked when they heard about. And I think it's probably telling that the first reaction that people had to hearing about this was to be appalled by it, without knowing any of the abortion implications or anything else, just the idea of creating babies in test tubes. They realized at a very fundamental level, that is not how you bring a child into the world, that there's something profoundly wrong about that. Now, a lot of the ways that gets explained is often in these kind of Aristotelian terms of the nature, the telos of the body. But I think there is just this argument from moral intuition that before we'd completely numbed ourselves to this, we recognized that this was something kind of shocking and horrific. Does that make sense?
And I totally agree. And it's very helpful to just hear it in different words in these types of conversations. They're like so emotional and personal, you know, from good people, yeah, that it's hard to talk about morality, but kind of appealing to just a general sense of what's right and wrong is maybe the simple way to do it. But yeah, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd love to send you a book that we have, if you'd like it. It's called Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. It's a few years old, but it's got magnificent essays in it. And if you would like it, it's about the whole, it's about contraception, of course, but about the whole kind of Catholic response to the sexual revolution in a broader sense. And so this might be of great interest to you, Sean. If you'd like it, hang on the line. We'll send you Inseparable. It really is one of our best books, and I don't talk about it enough. Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. Hang on. Give us that address. We'll send it, and we will take a quick break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on, we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Alexian Brothers is a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. For 800 years, these Catholic brothers have offered a prophetic and daring response to the gospel. Serving Christ in the sick, the poor, and the dying. Is God calling you to be a courageous disciple? If you feel called to total self-giving as a religious brother in the mission of Jesus, call our vocations office at 847-264-8703. That's 847-264-8703. AlexianBrothers.org.
Want the latest pro-life news? Want it delivered? Sign up. It's free. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, your source for everything happening now in the fight to protect the sanctity of human life. New episodes delivered every week to your inbox. So if you really want to know,
sign up today.
Go to EWTN.com/pro-life today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. There's a line open, so jump on that. 888-318-7884. I don't care what the question is either, because it's asked me anything today. So, yeah, that line is for you. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. I do want to just tell one little thing about our European pilgrimage, and then I might be done talking about it. But the people that went with us were an extraordinary witness to the Christian faith. And it really was something beautiful to see. It wasn't just a trip. It wasn't just a tour. It was people being on pilgrimage. And I know that it struck other people that way because quite a few of the crew we were on the AMA Siena. AMA is the river cruise company, the European river cruise company we were with. And I was very touched by the way they told us, Joe, on the last day there about how they had never seen a group like this before. They had never had a group like that on the boat. And it was quite beautiful. First of all, AMA does a beautiful job, and we really loved the crew. But I think that they felt loved. And I think that that's a beautiful witness to the pilgrims who came. Not to us, to them.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. I mean, and seeing the kind of reaction the crew had, they're professionals. They're great at what they do and making people feel seen and welcomed and everything else. And so I think they came away feeling loved and appreciated. And it was really wonderful.
It really was.
I would add on that, it was also really wonderful right after that when we went to Stuttgart and we were on base and we talked to people who'd come from a couple hours away.
What was the name of the base, Joe? Patch Barracks.
Patch Barracks.
You would have got it eventually.
But. That's the name of the barracks. There's like three or four different barracks.
Four barracks anyway, there in Stuttgart, yeah.
Yeah.
So what
but were you it was really wonderful. People were, driving from a long way away because they don't normally get Catholic English-speaking apologists in Germany. And so it was a joy to get to do that with them. And, I mean, I'd love to do something like that again. So, yeah, it's been a wonderful time lately.
Yeah, that was very, very rewarding. The chaplaincy, Trinity, is it Blessed Trinity or Holy Trinity? The chapel there on the base.
I don't remember.
I think it's Holy Trinity. Wait, I have the glass right behind me. They gave me a glass. Yeah, Holy Trinity.
Way to subtly drop that they gave you a glass.
I put it up there on the shelf. Do you like it, Edgar? Yeah, Edgar likes it. Did you notice that I put a glass up there? So Holy Trinity Paris, they invited the Germans to come in. And so there were a lot of folks from Germany who also came in. There were so many wonderful people, but like just give you one example, Joe. Albin and his wife.
Yes.
And I remember Albin's name because he's from Albania. And you immediately meet someone named Albin from Albania, you go, Albin from Albania? And he's like, yes, everyone comments.
Be like
on
naming a kid here, United Stat.
Yeah. United Stat from the United States.
You can't just take your country and cut off the last two letters.
But Albin is an actual person. So the Muslims raised in Islam in Albania came to Christianity via the internet and then discovered Catholic Answers and other, not just us. I'm going to try to take all the credit for it, but other Catholic. And then they realized that they were Catholic. And so they came into the Catholic Church, and then they came to see us on this military base. And I thought, you just can't get a more interesting story. And something is happening out there, Joe. I want people to feel encouraged by this, that there's the message is getting through to people. The message of Jesus Christ and his church is getting through to people.
Yeah, it's true. And there's something really beautiful about that. And it's exciting to see it outside of the U.S. because I've seen the numbers and I've witnessed it personally here in America. And to see signs of life in places that in some ways are doing worse, to be very frank. Germany's got a lot of struggles right now. But meeting, we met a very good German priest.
A very good German priest.
We saw a lot of really great German Catholics So yeah, it's
who wrote on the board? My neighbor's name is Canada. Who that was you, Darren? Some people.
I think our whole country could say that.
Our neighbor's name is Canada. Yeah, I'm sorry, but that reminds me of Jiminy Glick. I forget the Canadian movie star that he was interviewing. He goes, "You're from Canada."
Hey everyone, I'm sorry if you have questions. They're not getting answered today because Si's going down memory lane.
"You're from Canada," Jiminy Glick said. Do you need me to talk slower? Emma in Hayden, Idaho, watching on YouTube. Hi, welcome back, Emma.
Thank you. You are welcome back too. We missed you guys.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh,
I heard they did a good job without us.
Where's the rest of our colleagues?
You know what Edgar said is that your job is tough.
Edgar said that?
You do it so well, you make it look effortless. Yes, he did.
Oh my gosh. I'm never going to let Edgar live that down.
Everything Si does seems tough.
Yeah, somehow you make it look harder than it is. That's what people usually say to me. Somehow you take the easy and you really make it look hard.
Joe, didn't make it to Moscow for your debate. My husband had to work and he likes to eat, so he couldn't take me down there. But I watched it. You smoked him. I was so impressed. Even my husband
said
he was impressed.
Thank you. I'm honored.
And
that's very kind of you.
You're welcome. I was listening to your podcast about the sacrifice of the mass, and it was really good. But when I talk to my Protestant friends, they say, "Well, we have a sacrifice of praise." So how do I rebuttal that? What do I say?
Well, I think we would just say, "Yeah, that's also true." In fact, we can also talk about making sacrifices in our own bodies. So Romans 12 says, "I appeal to you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." That we can engage in acts of worship within our own bodies. And I'm not meaning to deny any of that. I think there's often a misunderstanding of prayer and worship among Christians, and particularly within Protestantism. But that doesn't mean that they're not doing any worship. A lot of what they call worship may not be, but other things that they may not think of as worship, like when they sacrifice, that is. So the issue is not that they don't offer worship at all. The issue is the highest form of worship is the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. And at the Mass, we participate in the sacrifice of the cross, that we become sharers in the altar, to use the language of St. Paul. So in 1 Corinthians 10, when Paul is talking about the Eucharist, he points to Israel and says, "Consider the practice of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partners in the altar?" So if you wanted to share in the Passover sacrifice, the way you did it was by eating the sacrifice. And so we want to share. We don't just want to offer our own sacrifices, our sacrifices of praise and the bodily sacrifices that we make. Those are all good. But the best sacrifice is the one that is beyond our capacity to make of ourselves. It's Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. And we become partners in that, according to St. Paul, by eating the sacrifice. Well, the sacrifice is Jesus' own body and blood. So we have to somehow eat Jesus' own body and blood to share in his sacrifice. And that is precisely what happens at the Mass. This is why we refer to it as the sacrifice of the Mass, that we present Jesus' sacrifice to the Father. We unite with Jesus' sacrifice all of our little acts of praise, of self-offering. This is why we have the offertory in Mass. This is a sacrificial gift that we give to take all of our little sacrifices and unite them with Jesus' big sacrifice and present those to the Father. And, you know, it's almost like if you, this is a trivial example, but if you've ever been in an office place where somebody gets a really good gift for a coworker, and then you just like sign on there and you're like, "Now it's from all of us." You know, this is kind of how it works. Jesus does the hard work of dying on the cross, and we share by offering up our own prayers and sacrifices, and then by consuming him, by eating the sacrificial offering, his own body and blood. And so this is something bigger than a mere sacrifice of praise. So sacrifices of praise are great. Bodily sacrifices are all good. But this is the sacrifice par excellence that we're really called to as Christians.
Emma, you can hear the music, so that means we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. The lines continue full, but usually at these breaks, they will open up a little bit. So give us a try. 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is the podcaster behind the Shameless Potpourri podcast. If you look for Shameless Potpourri online, you will find it. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. It's available on YouTube and all the sites, all the stuff. You can find Joe out there. More and more people are discovering. He can go into a bit more depth there on the topics that we discuss here. And lots of great topics there for you to find. Shameless Potpourri. Look for it wherever you get your content. Right back with more Joe, 888-318-7884.